This is an interview with Thomas G. Doe for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm Kenneth Durr. The date is May 19, 2014, and we're in Rockville, Maryland. Thanks for taking some time to talk.
Glad to be here.
So let's start with you know what one would expect, which is some background. You're from Massachusetts originally.
Grew up outside of Boston. My father was an apple grower. Went from there to Colgate University. First job was in college admissions, so kind of was had an educational institutional bent. Always interested in how higher ed institutions operated. So that then led me to a master's degree from Harvard in education, not business. And everything what my degree is administration, planning, and social policy. So it was during that period of time that in order to pay for room and board during graduate school, I was a squash coach at a private secondary school, and it was the parent of one of those players who was involved with a company called Municipal Market Data. And I was hired after graduation, worked there for 10 years, and that's where I developed my understanding of the municipal bond market, because it was a research firm, one of the technical analytical area.
And yeah, tell me a little bit about the firm when you got there. What was, I mean, this must have been all very different for somebody still relatively young, and you hadn't been focusing on securities.
There were only, there were four people involved with it, and I had an ability to sell, so they had me selling research product, and they would in turn teach me about the financial markets. And you're correct, I knew little about the difference between a stock and a bond, let alone a municipal bond. And from there, about the same time that I began, that is when the Chicago Board of Trade then had developed a futures on municipal bonds. And so that became an area of my expertise and led me into understanding derivatives, because that was a new area to the municipal bond industry. So I was essentially starting at the same point of everybody else who may have had a more extensive background in what we call the cash market.
But the derivatives were new for everybody.
Right. So I could learn from that point. And then when we sold the company to Thomson, that was in 1994. And then 1995, I started my firm, Municipal Market Advisors.
Well, tell me a little bit about, you jumped through a pretty sizable span of time there.
Okay.
You got into MMA, or MMD,
yes.
Two MMs, and you, so you're doing some selling and you're learning about derivatives. Are you working, are you putting together one of these scales or indexes?
Is that we were writing commentary on the marketplace, which I began doing in the focusing on the futures market. That then led over to, as I developed a better understanding of the cash market, of writing on that area. The indexes that the company developed, I had some role in, but during the time, my tenure at that firm, they were nowhere near as prominent as they are today. And because we never intended them to be that, and that's another story. But we then developed a risk management consulting practice at Municipal Market Data. And so when the company was sold, it was that those clients that I was allowed to take with me to start my firm.
Okay.
So my firm started as a risk management consulting firm for eight institutions that were involved in using interest rate futures and cash securities to hedge predominantly their interest rate exposure in municipal bonds.
Wow. Now, was this a spinoff, or did you just go and start
I just
over
went
again?
And started on my own.
Okay.
The prior, by the gentleman, Dick Dobbins, who had founded Municipal Market Data, he and I established an arrangement where I did some trading for him in the futures market. We had a fairly robust and successful trading model, And so we managed funds, and it was the proceeds from those funds during when we had that, when I started Municipal Market Advisors, that was the revenue that enabled him to fund CivilWarData.com.
Okay,
and
this is the
pay
guy.
For all the pay for people to input soldiers' histories in the Civil War.
How about that? So tell me a little bit about this risk management consulting. Mm-hmm. What kind of work is this? This is municipal?
So we had several clients. We had several dealer firms who were positioning municipal bonds as inventory. And so during the time that those bonds were in inventory and before they were distributed to investors, those security dealers had risk. And it was that risk that we helped to mitigate through the use of futures and options predominantly. The other other types of firms that we worked with were originators of product called unit investment trusts. And unit investment trusts were, and still are, a product of where municipal bonds, predominantly of a specific state, and bonds that shared similar characteristics, specifically rating and maturity, and they would be grouped together, and then shares of those unit investment trusts would be sold to individual investors. There's a process in that, in the creation of that end product, where the institution creating the product buys the security, and it's called the accumulation phase. And then there is a date certain that's called the deposit date when the trusts are formed. So the period of time when these specific bonds are purchased to the point of deposit, the originating firm, let's call it that, has interest rate risk. And so we were involved in hedging that risk. That probably was very formative for some of my interests, which are predominantly pricing and the challenges associated with indices and evaluations that I've spoken a fair amount about during my career, because it was then that we learned when we were hedging the market risk, the market was not a treasury bond going up and down or a security. It was actually the biases and tendencies of the evaluation models that at that time, Standard & Poor's and Mueller Data, which is now Interactive Data Corp, depending on how they evaluated bonds, was the measure of our profit and loss and what we were hedging. So that interested me in pricing and challenges the municipal industry has.
So there's a sense here that the prices weren't reflecting underlying value, so to speak. They're just sort of arbitrary in a way?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that there is, because the municipal marketplace has very few bonds that transact for all its outstanding. So it's a $4 trillion market. 1% of those bonds transact a day, which are now tracked by the MSRB. And those 1% is, you know, minimal in terms of trying to draw and extrapolate from that data an evaluation of price, but it's an evaluation on every outstanding security, right?
Right.
So our industry has the challenge of, it has mutual funds where a net asset value is mandated to be created every day, and investors who own individual bonds have those on their statements that now in this day and age they can watch during the day. And there has to be an expectation that there will be a evaluation on each of those securities. Where that evaluation comes a expectation of where that security could transact. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, a very difficult challenge for how the industry has evolved. The data itself isn't robust enough to have adequate price discovery to create evaluations that in all market conditions can be credible. So that's, you know, that's just the challenge.
And certainly it would have been an even greater challenge in the early 90s.
When there was no visibility at all.
Right. So Standard & Poor's is doing this. And another firm you talked about.
It's now called Interactive Data Corp.
Okay.
It was called Mueller back then.
Okay. How were they doing it? What was layman's?
They would have people that would call around in a fairly laborious manner and ask people for prices, and they would ask both their customers and people who were selling bonds to the customers. And there were a number of mutual funds. Remember, the advent of the mutual fund in the late 1970s is what really mandated the need for evaluation services, because there had to be that daily NAV value. And so with that became what I consider an impossible task to create credible evaluations. So people do their best efforts. And yes, back in the 70s, and when bonds, until 1999, municipal bonds were traded in 5 basis point increments. Now they trade in 1 basis point increments. But that which is large, I mean, that's a 0.5% out in the 30-year maturity, that's a pretty wide swath. And, of course, the municipal market, as it gets more data, and the MSRB provides it more data, is that everybody has expectations that now I can see more, well, therefore we should then have all sorts of, and it comes down to regulatory standards, and people start thinking, trying to push the data further than it can go.
But the increments are coming down from
5 to 1.
And is that when the spreads are getting wiped out too at the same time?
Correct.
Okay.
Tighter market, more visible market. I wouldn't say more efficient. I would just say there's more awareness of where transactions are.
Okay. And in this period, well, we're starting to see disclosure. 15C212
right.
comes in, and that's disclosure in the primary market.
Right.
Did that make a difference for you in the work you were doing?
The work that I was doing, it was always part of the discussion. That and G37, right. which was the pay for play type of regulation, was, and I have to, you'll have to work with me here because I always can't remember all these.
G36 kind of went along with 15Z212 because it's the MSRB's take on the disclosure.
Right.
Yeah, and then G37 comes up.
But we were always, during my tenure, disclosure was always a discussion point. Of course, we were also instituting the real-time trade reporting system, went online during my tenure on the MSRB, but G37, the whole concept pay to play was always part of the discussion. It never went away.
Okay, but in the 90s here, in the years when you're
I'm early 2000s,
yeah.
Right? So this, a lot of this was preceding.
Right. I'm sort of getting sure. heading toward the MSRB.
Okay.
And I just want to get a better sense of the area you're working. One, it appears that you're working on your own rating system or whatever you call it at this point.
We've always been a research firm to analyze the market conditions.
Right.
And so our clients of our firm at Municipal Market Advisors are virtually all participants in the marketplace of every aspect of the transaction. So from issuer to securities firm to investors to high net worth individuals, people who are seeking to have an understanding of the market. And so our research reports that we generate and publish and sell on a subscription basis are directed toward improving the dialogue that between the participants of the transaction.
Okay.
I've always thought of our firm as being one where there are capital needs for public infrastructure. Those needs come from entities of all shapes and sizes, some large, some small, all have various degrees of knowledge of the marketplace, and it's in our best interest at being people who want to have public infrastructure needs met and funded in the best manner possible to lower its cost is to improve that dialogue and understanding of the market. So, you know, this draws back on my educational background and interest is that we really see ourselves as educators.
Right.
To the extent that we created data, it helped us to understand the market because, again, from that risk management experience that I had, is that I understood that the municipal market responded to evaluations generated by third parties and that those influence their daily behavior. So, you know, a very popular field now is behavioral economics, and I think the municipal market is a model for that.
Yeah.
You know, I also think that the municipal market in terms of raising capital for issuers is kind of the original crowdsourcing, right? Another popular term, because the largest holder of municipal debt, or if you want to think of it another way, the largest lender to public infrastructure projects are individuals. So you're gathering all these eclectic people together in a very kind of cumbersome process in order to get money to a single entity to build a school, hospital, and that became that's very interesting to me because that's very complex.
Now, that wasn't always the case, though. Before the 86 Tax Reform Act, a lot of banks would buy municipals and institutions. Is that correct?
Well, I'd say the world changed in the 1970s when mutual funds began because you had very high interest rates at the start of the 1980s from the high inflation. And the mutual fund companies, specifically Fidelity, that was probably the greatest marketer of municipal bond funds. You know, Vanguard and Dreyfus, I think, were the others, perhaps what Scudder then, but which was owned by now owned by Deutsche Bank, or that's been blended in. But those entities saw the opportunity of this historic high interest rate. Well, now we can put investors, we can put you and I into a product, charge a management fee, provide this perception of credit risk of bonds that are very difficult, and we can ride this historical anomaly of interest rates all the way down from very high levels to low levels, which will enable us to show tremendous total rate of return performance that will compete as an equity. We can sell it like an equity product, which they knew very well pre the creation of bond funds. So you went from this municipal bonds owned predominantly by individuals and banks, you're correct there, to then shifting to, again, crowdsourcing of these individuals into mutual funds. And now we have large entities that could have aggregated capital so that larger issuers could raise more capital in a more efficient manner because now the capital had been aggregated in the fund and the underwriter of bonds could go to that one fund and raise $200 million right away because the mutual fund had already aggregated all those individuals right into the fund. Are you with me there?
Yes, I
understand that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I would say that was a big turning point in the municipal market and mutual funds really began in the municipal bond industry only 3 years after the MSRB was started in 75.
Huh.
Right? So, so its regulation of dealers kind of coincided with this new entity that was a fast and, you know, who had a huge marketing power behind, you know, Fidelity, because I'm from Boston area. Ned Johnson, whose family has run that firm for decades, probably was the most aggressive marketer, you know, taking the maitre d' of a very popular restaurant and featuring them in advertisements so that every man could be seen as buying of municipal bonds through this new product.
Okay, sort of the Jim Liebenthal model.
Yeah. Right, but now you had it in a product that was big. But everyone was telling a story, right, and marketing bonds. Everybody's a salesman. Yeah.
I wanted to get a sense of how things changed, because I do get a sense that there was a big development in the municipal bonds business, sort of the types of bonds that were being issued. and the complexity of the market going from the 80s into the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what happened is, and then where I came into it in the mid-1980s, so 1984 is when I entered into the industry,
right.
and as I said earlier, coincided with the advent of the futures contract. So that brought derivatives into the municipal marketplace, and with that came a kind of a new perception of or a different talent pool came into the market, because now math became a more interesting, leverage became a greater part of the product. Arbitrage were words that were now being used a lot, and now we were trading futures and all sorts of exciting things, you know, like that. And so it brought quantitative analysis into the municipal industry in a more robust way. And I think that brought proprietary trading. Capital was allocated to that in the futures market, brought firms like Susquehanna, a large proprietary trading firm in Philadelphia, into the municipal bond industry. They did extraordinarily well, and you had a tool that could be hedged. The futures now could be used as a risk management tool. The problem that with all these derivatives that's evolved, and we then saw future, and we can get to it, but is because the municipal bonds are tax exempt, the tax code prohibits the shorting or the selling of municipal bonds. So what happens is that because now if you create a derivative product and it's undervalued and you want to own it and you want to arbitrage, you want to sell the cash instrument, well, you can't do that in municipal bonds. So it creates inefficiencies in the derivative products that become, you know, can become difficulty for that those instruments to grow to the size to really service the market adequately.
Now, is that a more recent problem? Or
no, it's been in existence since bonds were created. And okay. So every iteration, whether it's been futures in the 1980s, interest rate swaps, credit default swaps that came into our market, the evolution of tender option bond programs that were a huge chapter in the municipal industry, the creation of exchange-traded funds and municipal bond, all these things that could benefit from a risk management tool, or that you're all have this Achilles heel because there's not an arbitrage opportunity, because you cannot sell short the cash market.
Does that get us to where you have to give the money to the IRS? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, it's just that I'm not an entity that can create tax exempt interest. So even if it's a taxable equivalent amount, it's still I'm participating in this product in a way that's not the IRS frowns upon,
right?
Because the idea, right, is we have this benefit in order to serve the public good.
Right. Something else that's coming up, coming along in this same period is bond insurance is becoming more and more ubiquitous, I guess.
Correct.
What was the effect of that during these early years, 80s, 90s?
Well, it became critically important to the 1980s. And it comes back to, again, you're going to hear my comments, a bias toward this challenge of trying to create some kind of credible and evaluation on a security that now more and more people can see prices, more and more people are seeing them on their investor statements, as we go from investors never having statements to having them quarterly, to having them monthly, then having them daily online in the 1990s, is that now we can see these prices, and there's also a greater interest because of the advent of the mutual fund, where the fund manager is compensated on how well they can perform, and it's a total rate of return performance. So it means not just owning a bond and generating income, but now I'm going to give you some principal appreciation for my ability to buy bonds cheap and sell them at a higher price. And so that whole concept of performance then created more secondary transactions. So what bond insurance did is that in its, you know, in its ideal was to protect the individual investors who were buying on bonds that were distressed credits. But bond insurance thrived because municipal bonds historically have an unbelievably low default rate. So you were providing insurance to entities that had very little risk to them. And you were providing that insurance, one, why it was popular. One was because individual investors really don't know much about the municipal bond market. They really don't care much about it. They care about the interest rate they're getting. So one is it allowed for I'll pay something to know that I have AAA, that's safe. The other thing that it did is it commoditized prices. And so we had, I think, at the peak in the, I think it was early 2000s, that 60% of the primary market, so the initial time when bonds were initially sold, it was 60% carried AAA insurance. Bonds then could be insured in the secondary, maybe got the number up to maybe as high as 80 at, wow, you know, at a certain point in time. So now everything's priced similarly, right? There's an underlying credit, but now they're all very similar. And so that made it easier for you and I to transact bonds because they all look the same. There's no default risks. There aren't defaults. The New York City of the 1970s is a faded memory. Whoops of the 1980s is a faded memory. And so bond insurance is kind of this, you know, wonderful saving, you know, whitewash of the market that commoditized it.
Yeah, but when you use the word whitewash, there's something it's covering up, right?
Well, what it does is it enabled, because now think about what's happening too, is that the reality of the business of the municipal industry is that now we're having more and more competition of more people creating these bond funds, where in the late 1970s, you had three leaders, you know, again, the Fidelity, Vanguard, Drivens. Now you had, I don't know, 100 different fund families that are emerging. Everybody was doing municipal bond funds or unit investment trusts or any of these packaged products. So now there's a competition, right, of getting fees down. And Vanguard, of course, saying, well, you know, low fees is the way to go. That was coming in the bond world. So there was so interest rates are coming down. There's now a pressure on the fund families to drive their fees down. Mm-hmm. And we're driving transaction fees down. And so what was happening is that there was still a high cost of personnel because the fundamental basis or the fundamental characteristics of the municipal industry hadn't changed, in that you have over 55,000 different entities that are issuing debt, over a million different CUSIPs in this $4 trillion market. It's still confusing. There isn't adequate disclosure of financial information. So individual investors are unclear. Well, but now bond insurance comes in and says, you know, this is all good. Well, now, again, all these fees are coming down. So now what I can do, since I still have these problems, but I had now something was taking away the complexity. So now I don't have to have high priced people. So now what I can do is I can reduce my credit and analytical teams, because I can rely on the bond insurer to do my work for me. And I can rely on the rating agencies to also do the work for me. So now I can keep my margins as a mutual fund company still attractive but I can cut people. I can reduce staff.
Okay.
And I can do that also on the street as well. I can reduce my personnel because I don't need analysts anymore.
That's really interesting. I mean, the way I was thinking of it before is kind of like the information's not really there. You don't have the level of disclosure and the kind of information that is going to come about, you know, as the MSRB starts ramping up toward yeah. Emma. So, you know, I was wondering if the idea was essentially that the insurance was sort of substituting for that information, for the disclosure.
Well, no, because the insurance only said that somebody had done the review. They may not have had the adequate disclosure. I mean, they may have had a better effort. They were doing the hard work of getting the disclosure for those bonds they were going to insure. But you know, the, again, because the because municipal bonds are predominantly, probably until we get up into the late 2000s, is that municipal bonds were underwritten not to default.
Right.
Remember, what you're dealing with, you're in a public space. You've got the people that are borrowing the money. They're trying to do it for a purpose that's well known. Now, there have been there's transgressions that have been done for, you know, different securities firms that have, you know, some are gone out of the business that abused some of the purpose and took advantage of their client, I would say. But at the end of the day, you had somebody who was saying, I need to build that hospital, you know, get me a favorable financing. And the banker who's coming in or the firm who's underwriting that debt wants to do another transaction. So they're going to make sure this bond doesn't default. And because they're sold as safe securities, the investor, and again, mostly the high net worth individuals, you're selling the municipal bonds to your best customer, right? That you want to do more transactions with. So it's in everybody's best interest that these bonds don't go bad.
Right.
And so so even with all, you know, the emphasis on disclosure, and believe me, it's a good thing. I mean, if you borrow money, you should be able to show your financial wherewithal. But everybody who's involved in a transaction, and that's why it's taken so long, you know, 100 years to get to this point in disclosure, is that the bonds are underwritten not to default.
Right. I want to hit a couple. This is really great information. I know you don't have all afternoon, but
I've got until the Nationals game, so I've got to get work with you here.
All right,
I'm glad to do it.
I want to hit a couple of things before we head up into the MSRB years. Mm-hmm. One is I'm intrigued by '94, a particularly bad year mm-hmm. for bonds.
Yep.
I think the value drop is almost in half, or something
sure.
like that. What happened there? Tell me a little bit about the experience and what that. Really
so the ended. Early so it started in the early 19 early that year of 1994. In fact, 1994 is the only time that my wife's book club asked me what I did for a living, and the reason was that on the front page of the Wall Street Journal was the decline of the net asset values of mutual funds, and I think I was quoted in some in a story actually at that time, but and again it was high interest rates, but it was the first time that we had there was a lot of problem in the short-term securities. It was letters of credit. Japanese banks were under a lot of stress. And what had been, there was a product that was created in order to generate incremental yield for money market funds, were called inverse floaters. And this was kind of a precursor to tender option bond programs that mm-hmm. you know that will come a little bit later, but inverse floaters in 1994 essentially, to make it very simple, enabled mutual funds to incur leverage, and so again to try to get greater returns because they're still measured on total rate of return performance, compensation still is driven that way, and there's still a perception at that time, which is now no longer really the case, that performance increased assets into a mutual fund complex. You had some aggressive fund managers that had leverage. Interest rates went up sharply in 1994, in the early part of 1994. That meant that net asset values plummeted. This was a shock to investors, because 1993 we had a movement to lower interest rates, if memory mm-hmm. serves me correctly, and so then you have this vicious spike, and the Achilles heel of municipal bonds comes back to an early comment that only 1% of the market trades, and you really don't have, when we have the dominant buyer in the marketplace, and that's how I always characterize it. At that point, it was mutual funds. Is that when they shift, reverse course, and become a seller, is that that's disruptive to the point that the secondary market, there isn't adequate capital for an orderly secondary market, and so there isn't adequate price discovery, and you won't have that absence of efficiency creates a sharp decline in prices, and then feeds on itself. And then you'll have you or I continue to redeem our funds, our money from losing funds, and it just becomes this downward spiral. Again, because you only can make money in the municipal bond market by owning the securities, only being long, you can't be short. Mm-hmm. Right? So the as a result is that everybody can only make money one way. Well, when the more everything starts going down, it gets very bad.
Yeah.
And no one wants to buy bonds, and so you have these gaps. And also, back in 1994, something that exacerbated the situation was, again, as I was mentioning earlier, the bonds traded in 5 basis points increments. So before there was a print, it went down in large steps in prices because it wasn't as fine, right? You know, the 1 basis point increment.
Yeah.
So that's what happened in 1994. And then, so that created a lot of losses among some security dealers. I can't remember if people consolidated or who left the business at that time. We had had other shocks in the 80s, 86 specifically, that took some removed some firms from the market. That's a very similar condition to occurred. If we look back over time, there are probably, I think I've done charts on this, maybe there have been 20, 25 times since 1933 where we've had real significant rises in interest rates that have been that are directly related to whether it was the mutual fund or the banks leaving the industry or the tender option bonds purchasers leaving the market, all created these sharp, you know, really catastrophic periods in the municipal bond industry, which do two things. One is it destroys the profitability of the securities firms in the market. It reduces the revenue from the mutual funds, so those participants are gone. But also, it's because it engenders so much fear among those participants that it's, there's almost a 6 to 8 month period where issuers can't gain access to capital in an orderly way. Mm-hmm. And so it has this kind of a hangover where issuers have to pay more money in order to borrow because no one wants to take risk because they just had this horrific experience right. that they can't get out of their mind.
Right.
And management is panicked.
And Orange County won at the same time. That was
like it came at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Really, if you look at it from a look at data, it's almost a non-event. It's almost nothing happened.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, was it just because it was such an...
you had a single issuer. Was it Robert Citron, I think was
yeah,
the guy's
there,
name,
there you go. Yeah.
Who you know took all sorts of risk in underwriting securities. I think he was involved in, you know, against some of these... You know, I really can't remember exactly, but the bonds were insured.
Mm-hmm.
And so nobody... I don't think anyone lost any money on the whole thing. Citron lost his job, and there was a disruption because it was a... It did for some people who were probably in management positions at that time in their career. They had cut their teeth during whoops.
Yeah, right?
So
yeah,
they
yeah.
kind of went, "Whoa, this is you know this is a you know this is a major problem again."
Right.
We've got you know this is the '90s version of what
right.
we saw in the '80s and '70s.
And you're saying that's not the case?
I'd say it passed. Really, it was really a non-event.
I mean, well, the thing that made the news, of course, was that they were using swapped derivatives,
right.
And didn't really know what
Correct.
They were doing.
Correct.
And isn't this a concern at this point? Because this is starting to get more and more common.
Well, again, we had the inverse floaters were kind of the introduction of leverage, and that happened in the spring of 94. So, sure, yeah, I mean, there was the use of derivatives at that time. You know, and the whole question is for any of these people, is, you know, who's at fault? You know, you have someone who's looking for... who probably doesn't know a lot about the marketplace in the forms of an issuer. There are very few that are engaged on a daily basis to be, you know, super knowledgeable. But they have a need. They're trying to do something. They want the lowest cost of financing. You know, they have a number of different institutions that come in trying to solve that problem. And they essentially say, you know, here are your different choices. You can issue fixed, you can issue floating rate securities, you can issue some cocktail with derivatives in order to get this low financing rate. And you know, it's almost like going to the doctor and the issuer, you know, being the patient, goes to the banker and says, you know, I'm sick, you know, I have this problem, you know, and you say, well, here are your alternatives. And the right. discussion is, well, what would you do?
Right.
Well, I'm not you, right? The doctor says, I'm not you. I can't make that decision. And but it still comes back to what would you do, right? It still comes into that yeah. pressure of trying to get the answer because the patient or the issuer in this case just doesn't know.
Right.
He has a need, and it's an emotional position. And so all of a sudden, that's where bad decisions can be made. They may all be well-intended, but everybody is it's a financial transaction in which people are being compensated. So, you know, that enters into it. It's not a pure relationship. And mm-hmm. And so then there's a balance of where someone is taken advantage of or not. And so that comes down to the participants and the paid.
Right.
You know, that's why we have regulation, right?
Which happens. Right. But on the other hand, who would have, you know, you're helping to provide the information that can help these people make the decisions. Mm-hmm. Is that the case?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what's
mm-hmm.
going on? Mm-hmm. Who would your client be in a case like that?
Well, at that time in the 90s, I was just starting a firm, so we were still doing risk management. We hadn't okay. really had conversations or weren't providing our information to the depth that we are now,
okay.
you know, some 20 years later.
Yeah, something right. I ran into is when you introduced this thing called the consensus scale, and
right.
that's what I was getting to earlier. And
yes.
I want to talk a little bit about that, because mm-hmm. that's the introduction of that scale. What was that about?
Well, in 1999, he comes back with the challenges of data, which starts with evaluations back in the 1970s. So the issue is that I learn in... so here I did this tenure at Municipal Market Data, so I knew well the data that was being used that had become was becoming ubiquitous in the market in terms of determining daily evaluations, in terms of creating a basis for which a salesman would initiate a trade with an investor. It was being used in the same way that a treasury yield curve is used in the corporate market to determine spread to then quantify value. But what I knew because I had been involved in the creation of that data set is that I knew that it was not an index. I knew that it didn't have it wasn't robust statistically. And so there were risks associated with that. So in the 1999, I never really wanted to be in the data business. I'd done that. I was on to other things. But there had been created these derivative products that were called, and they still exist today, which are MMD rate locks, municipal market data mm-hmm. rate locks. And these rate locks were just a way of going long and short interest rates. And it was a over-the-counter market. There were very few participants involved in the creation of them. But I was aware they were occurring, and I thought, well, maybe the industry should try another way of creating an index and really do an index. So at that time, we were now 15 years before the LIBOR scandal, where surveying participants was... a good way of collecting data. So we surveyed both investors and securities firms to provide us their perception of where an index value would be. Mm-hmm. And we did that because we didn't have transparency in the municipal bond market. And because so few bonds traded, is that when there is a transaction, so even with the MSRB beginning their process in 94, right, of starting to put this system in place, is that even knowing the trades, the market's so small that it's incredibly important to know the intent of the people that are involved in the transaction, mm-hmm. to understand whether that transaction can be extrapolated to a broader use. And so my belief is that while it's great to have data, if you don't understand the data, then you're at risk. And so I thought that if I could create a data set that was fully transparent, where all the people participating were known, right. where I was taking data in and had a statistical process that was the same every day, and that any day, 10 years forward, I could recreate that data set of 10 years prior because I would have it and I could identify it. So if there was any regulatory scrutiny or if that data were used for the purposes of settlement of a derivative transaction and there was a dispute in arbitration, there was, you might not agree with the number, but the process would be transparent and known. Mm-hmm. And I could create that. And I knew that the process we did accomplished that. We continue to do it to this day, but it has nowhere near the prominence of MMD's data still persists as being the benchmark of the marketplace. Everyone knows there's a problem with it. There's been numerous articles about it. MSRB board members have commented publicly about the inherent manipulative problems associated with the data, and yet it's still used.
And this is a black box data. This is
absolutely,
you don't know what's
absolutely. Happening. It's never been known.
Okay. Why does it persist then?
Because there's never been a problem.
Okay. A nice, simple, easy answer.
It reminds me of when we had a product that was involved with determining the accrued interest for variable rate demand notes, and this was in the 1980s and 90s, and you would go to the trustee, and the trustee in a transaction with a mutual fund is the one who receives the check at the bank for the accrued interest from a security. And then the municipal market, the accrued interest calculations are as varied as are our creative minds in the banking world. And you would go to the trustee and you'd say, gee, this is a service we're providing. And they go, well, I've never had a problem. I always get the check. And so then we would then say, but, this is the amount of money. Did you receive this amount of money? And they go, oh, that's not the size of the check I got. I said, well, because the calculation was done incorrectly. Well, they'd never known because they just got the check. They didn't know how to confirm mm-hmm. it. So similarly, it's like bond insurance thrived because there was never a problem. It grew and proliferated because there wasn't a problem. And the data that the municipal market uses, persists because it's a problem that hasn't been one. No one has sued over a loss in a settlement. And so that's how it exists.
Let's go into the MSRB then. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're heading into this period. How does one get involved? How does one get put on the board?
There's a nominating committee. You usually had to go through it twice. It took me two interviews, two processes to be part of it. It was pretty much you knew people in the industry. You had some reputation or as being, knowledgeable and a person that you'd want to spend time on a board with.
Had you had involvement with the MSRB prior to this?
Well, I cut my teeth there was a process where you had to show that you had some commitment to do work, so I was put on the glossary committee of the MSRB, which was, writing the dictionary is terribly painful. Yeah. But, I knew that was paying my dues because I was a research firm. I was outside of the guys doing all the transactions. I wasn't at the closing dinners. I wasn't doing, that was my world. So, but there were people who had gotten to know me, mainly because of my work in the futures market. So, and where I'd been involved with the Board of Trade and around the contract. So that, gave me a little bit of exposure. So I did my work on the glossary committee and then was, nominated, went through the interview process, didn't get picked for whatever reason, and then resurfaced. That was in 99, so then 4 years later, I have the opportunity again, and this time the right dynamic. Again, because of the way the board was, you had to be the right person at the right time. You know, you had to. I was a public member, so I had to be a public member. That, you know, they wanted to have investors, they wanted to have an issuer, they wanted to have. So you had to kind of fit the right mold. And since I was this independent research firm, you know, was I independent? What was the? So it was all kind of a challenge. But so I got on, and I was glad to do it.
So what did you find when you got on? Tell me a little bit about sort of sizing the board up and seeing what their priorities were.
So you walk in the first day, and it's you see representatives from usually at that time, you know, five of the larger firms. So there were people from Goldman Sachs, UBS, Lehman Brothers at the time, you know, big guns, you know, people that have, you know, big reputations, certainly larger than me. And then you had a second cut of group that were usually smaller regional representatives and smaller firms. And then you had the public entities, and those were issuers, and then usually heads of like a mutual fund company or something like that. And I usually knew those people better, because I knew the buy side better than I knew the dealer side in some ways.
Why was that?
Just because we were writing and producing research about the transaction, so we became more of a check, you know, a third-party review of the market condition as opposed to the entity that was selling securities. Mm-hmm. So we were, so the investors gravitated to us first, as to the issuers.
Yeah. Now, you've just chopped the MSRB up into these groups.
Right.
Did, in the deliberations, the discussions, did those groups tend to stick together? Did they?
No. Okay. No. And in fact, you know, it was interesting, as I was saying earlier, that in recounting some of the history of the municipal market, is that when it's had adversity, it's been responsive. And I'd say most of the challenges in the municipal market have been because it's always responded to things. It's never, it's rarely initiated efforts. Hmm. So it's when a crisis occurred, then it responded, created regulation. Everybody jumps up and down to do change, but rarely looking forward. You know, they wait for the problem. Hmm. Has been kind of the history of the market. And so we walk in, I remember the first board meeting, Hill Feinberg at First Southwest was chairman, and we sat in a room in Carlsbad, California in 2003 at the Four Seasons, because at that time, you know, still went to nice places. And that was, and we talked about derivatives and the problems that we thought existed in the market. Now, in 2003, the aforementioned these tender option bond programs started proliferating, and this allowed securities firms to take tremendous leverage in the marketplace in order to take long maturing bonds and create synthetic short-term securities that could feed the demand of municipal tax-free money market funds, which were in the late 1990s, the only areas of growth in the mutual fund complexes were money market funds and high yield. So these two entities, so you had money market funds that needed a lot of product, and there was a need for that, for variable rate product, and so the industry said, okay, we can take these 30-year bonds that issuers need in order to do long-term capital projects, and we can, through our magic, create a synthetic security that the money market funds need, and that's where we get the loan, the source of capital. That's where mm-hmm. the loan's going to come from. Mm-hmm. So we sat around in 2003 talking about how this was going to be a problem for the market, and of course, it eventually was in 2008.
What was the problem? What were the problems you were looking at in 2003?
Is that there was going to be too much leverage in the marketplace. that the issuers who were involved in the transactions didn't understand the risks that they were taking by having a large variable rate exposure as opposed to fixed, and that could cause, if there were stresses, that could create budgetary problems. And we thought there were probably public finance professionals that were not operating in the best interest, perhaps of the issuers, because at that point, because of the amount of capital that was going into these proprietary operations, these tender option bond programs, again, banks were doing it, so the investment bank world was involved. Is that the you could take, again, everything's AAA, right? So you that gave you more comfort with leveraging the product. And so it was almost free money, and it was for a long period of time, a tremendous amount of revenue. So risks are to be taken also on the underwriting, and we see it now looking back in time that by, you know, just 5 years later or 4 years later from this board meeting is that we saw issuers being loaned money through the investment, through the municipal bond market, and they never should have received the loan. But it was that the demand was there. It was just like throwing, you know, wood into the steam engine's furnace. You could put anything in it. The fire was so hot because, and they needed it, and they generated it. And the returns were, I mean, the money was crazy. All these, the larger firms in particular, were building larger and larger positions, creating products, selling them overseas. Everybody was enamored with this product. But in 2003, we saw the problem. But that created then an issue for the board because we recognized the problem, but the statute that guides the MSRB prohibited us as a board from regulating derivatives. So yet there had been an issue in derivatives from 1994. Here we are 10 years later, 9 years later, discussing the advent of interest rate swaps, a growing product, and yet the statute that was governing the main regulatory entity of the municipal industry was unable to address a product that had evolved that would have direct impact on the area of the market we could regulate.
So this tender option bond programs, this is what you're talking about. These are long-term bonds, and then you're hedging them more or less with these interest
rate swaps. You're taking that your mechanism is you're stripping off the coupon, and then you bifurcate the coupon, and you create trusts, and there are all sorts of. But the simple essence: you take a long security, fixed rate security, and transform it into a variable short term security.
Okay.
And so you're taking a product that's unsellable because there's no demand for a 30-year bond, and you create it to be a short term security. Right. And in that transformation is a tremendous spread that is retained by the creator of it, and there's also an ongoing revenue stream from the remarketing of the short the variable security to the money market funds.
But derivatives are the tool with
right because you use swaps to hedge and all
okay.
this. But the products themselves were also they're all linked to derivatives. This transformation of fixed to synthetic involves swaps, and swaps are derivatives. And yet, so everyone at the table. Everyone at the table knew there was a problem, but then the question is, how was this board going to respond to that? What could we do? And that became an issue on the board, and for the 3 years I was on it was, and again, you had a climate in D.C. at the time where we were being told as a board that no one would listen to our concerns because it was the Greenspan era, derivatives are good, And this became a problem because there was a group of us on the board, which I was one of them, that pressed to be on the record somewhere that we were aware of a problem. And was there a hearing that we could participate in? Was there something that we could talk about these hearings? But then that became the issue of which I testified in front of the Senate about. And this was the interesting dynamic, is that derivatives were making money for all the Wall Street firms in a big, big way. And not in municipals, but on the corporate side, that's where all the money was being made on the firms on Wall Street. And it was extraordinarily difficult for the largest firms, for the representatives on the board, to state publicly that these derivatives had risks that were a concern, because they would lose their job, and people did. So, and those who spoke up, their firms wouldn't tolerate it, and it would be used against them too. So the board, it was very difficult for the board to initiate. There was risks associated with establishing regulatory precedent, because the municipal bond industry, even though or the department was making money, it was small compared to what the rest of the firm was doing. So it was expendable, and therefore you were expendable if you took any risk that might jeopardize the rest of the firm.
And you saw this happen?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, no question about it.
So you're just talking about putting up the marker here and saying, we don't think this is a good idea.
So what we can do, and Frank Ingrassia, to his credit, who was chairman and was a Goldman, did his best to, when he spoke publicly, to rattle the saber and to make, he really displayed a tremendous amount of integrity and took personal risk, professional risk. And he'd have to say it. I would speculate that his career was shortened by it. But he'd have to confirm.
So this was one that you dealt with the entire time while you were on.
Mm-hmm. It was always a topic of discussion.
Yeah. Was that the most pressing topic through that period?
Well, then this gets to, this is where we started then looking. Then the issue that was evolving the same year that I came on the board, and was the this came into then the or how the board was structured, and the organizational aspect of the board. And what came to light in 2003 was that we didn't know that Kit Taylor, the executive director you've talked with, the board didn't know he had a contract. And where the sensitivity arose is because, remember, Grasso, who was chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, had just been given an extraordinary deal in his retirement, and there was a lot of public consternation around it because the number was large. And so the collection of people on the board at that time thought, do we have a similar problem? Could we have a similar problem? So we should do our best efforts as board members to be sure that we weren't at personal risk for not being aware of compensation. So no one until Deke Eichelhart, who was chairman of the admin committee in 2003, discovered the contract. And I can't remember how he unearthed it, but he didn't get it through Kit. And it was a contract that was it was outdated legally. Amendments had been made by footnotes in the margins and initialed by the chairmen of that time. And we started there was that what were the elements of it? And the aspect of the contract, it was an evergreen contract, So every 3 years it renewed. And Kit was of the age that had the contract, had the board remained ignorant of the contract, is that he would have vested in 2005, I think my last year on the board, in which case he would have been, you know, everything would have been, whatever was set, was his compensation would have been established. But there were issues regarding the compensation of the officers of the board. And because we had this contract and none of us really knew what was fair and what was right, is that that's when we engaged a gentleman named Ray Cotton, who became the legal counsel to the board, was on the initiative of Tom Federer, who was head of Eaton Vance, and Ben Watkins, who was the head of debt of the state of Florida. And so we began that process of reviewing the contract. And the interesting, I'll never forget, if I was talking with one of my fellow board members at the time, and the first meeting that we had with Ray Cotton, and Ray's expertise was compensation for college and universities presidents. And mm-hmm. he represented, at that time, Gordon Gee, who was among the more notable, mm-hmm. notorious might be another word, but charismatic university presidents and highly compensated. And Ray and Gordon was one of his clients. So we knew that Ray knew how to gain aggressive comp, so we thought he'd be a good selection. So we met with him in the D.C. offices, and Ray sat down with us, and he said, well, let me see if I can... I've been spent some time over the MSRB. Can you... I want to see if I can talk to you about... just talk some facts with you. Well, you have a... and I may be off on some of the numbers, but essentially have a entity that has annual revenue of $12 million. And... So that's a small business. Said you have 60 people that are on staff. Again, a relatively small number of people. The revenue is generated by fees that are determined by transactions that occur in the marketplace. So there's no revenue generation responsibility by any of the employees at the at the entity. So that, yes, all these things are true. He said, and yet the compensation of your executive director is nearly 8% of the gross revenue of the entity, and there's no revenue responsibility, there's no contract negotiation, there's a litany of things. Yeah. He said, compared to what I do, is what you have to help me understand is what is so special about this industry and what's so special about this individual. And that began fairly, then it became of, well, because now we had this, we knew that we had this pension thing. And if we couldn't explain those things to an outsider in an adequate way, then we got concerned about what the liability might be to the board. And then that became then there was a push that the contract had to be changed because it was outdated anyway. Mm-hmm. And so then the compensation elements of the executive director had to be reviewed. And there were aspects of that were didn't look right optically. And there were other elements that drove compensation and practices and that had been developed by the board that didn't set right. And so during the tenure, if we weren't talking about derivatives, we spent an inordinate amount of time talking about this change that was going to have to be effected mm-hmm. with the organization. And it's really, what it became like. It was like having a founder. I think the emotion around it, which became really difficult, was, and I certainly am empathetic to Kit's position of here he comes in. He was a very smart man, very knowledgeable guy, very personable guy, generous in many ways. But he had founded a company, and now 20 years had 30 years had passed, and the industry had changed. We could all see with these derivatives, you know, things were happening that seemed outdated, and operations seemed outdated. And it seemed that, again, as an SRO, that there had to be a different standard in terms of our, as a board, as to, you know, how we were going to be measured, and we were representing the industry then at that point in a visible way. So we had to be aggressive in terms of being very objective. I mean, to put the industry first and recognize this and provide opportunities for the you know, for change to occur. And the process, as you will learn from others, if you haven't, I think it was a 4-year process, yeah, to finally get it. But we froze this contract, and with that freezing of the contract, ignited the succession, and then ultimately a change in the organization, which, you know, it is what it is. But I correspond to you in an email is that a lot of the time was on what was this entity, how was it going to operate, and so that came into certainly my interest, because as I was saying earlier, my interest in educational institutions. If I had another career path, I would have wanted to be a college or university president, yeah, and because I thought it's just so fascinating, all these different how an institution works. You know, my work now is how an industry works. So now here I am at a table, and we're trying to figure out, how does this institution go forward, and what changes? How is it? How should it operate?
You were worried a great deal about the executive, and as you said, sort of if you take the New York Stock Exchange and what had happened there as an example, mm-hmm, a worst case, that's a good thing to be concerned, correct, about. Sounds like you also looked more broadly at the entire MSRB and how it was structured as far as...
At that time, it was more casual conversations, we saw that the MSRB was on a path of really having two agendas. One is a regulatory of just establishing the rules of how and a group of people are supposed to play in the sandbox together, right? Mm-hmm. And the second one was the emergence of growing a technology company, right, which was occurring because of collecting the trade data. And then, of course, we could see down the road that there was going to be a disclosure, an opportunity of centralizing that. So now you have a data company that's operating as well. So you have a group of lawyers and you have a group of technology people. You know, and so now you have it. And with that comes, you know, the industry now is growing, in that we see it because of the tender option bonds or more transactions. New issue volume is rising. With lower interest rates, money's now coming, is going to grow and come into the municipal market. So the MSRB, because of the growth of transactions and of primary volume, its revenue is going to grow. So you have this entity now that's going to become not this smaller company. It's still a small company, but I don't even know where the revenue, I mean, it must be $40 million maybe now or something, yeah, like that. I can't remember. But it's now grown, again, as a function, yeah, of all these fees that are collected.
Right. The thing that you're just talking about was long and fairly intractable. Mm-hmm. You had the issue of the derivatives, which you really couldn't touch, but you could be very concerned about, mm-hmm, them. How about some things that you could deal with? The consultants rule was one thing that was going around at the,
yeah,
time.
I mean, you know, and this was again, yeah, we were just talking to the guy, my fellow board member, who we were in that conversation about. It was an end of a 3-hour conversation, board meeting we had. It was just 3-hour debate on this one topic, and so we were trying to define what is a consultant, because you had entities that were working with issuers to provide different forms of expertise, some technical, and maybe like an engineer around a water and sewer financing, or it may be less clear, where it might be an advisor who's participating in this dealer over another securities firm making, helping with that choice. Right. It's a little bit more soft. And so the question was, which consultant is real? And is there any kind of bad behavior that's being fostered? And so what we tried to do was to define the consultant to these people of technical expertise. And I think it became, that might have been kind of a, looking back on it, maybe the first kind of germ of looking at the whole financial advisory process that now today is a SEC has put forth the municipal advisor rule and mm-hmm. what does it mean? How are issuers supposed to be counseled?
Mm-hmm. And this goes in with pay to play as well, right?
The right. Consulting thing. Again, it all comes back to, a gentleman named Marlon Mosby who worked at a company called PFM. He's retired now, and we were having dinner a number of years ago, and he said the municipal industry is kind of fascinating in that you have two extremes of ignorance. You have the people who are in need of the capital to borrow. It's not that they're ignorant meaning they're stupid, it's that they just don't have day-to-day expertise in borrowing money in the capital markets. And I always have bristled when people say, oh, this issuer is not sophisticated. Well, they may be very sophisticated in how they do their collective bargaining agreements and pension plans and all this. They just may not have a good understanding of how to borrow money because they don't do it very often, right? So, but if we use this to be blunt, is that the ignorant issuer on one side, and then we have the ignorant individual investor on the other side that we were talking earlier who had that salve of bond insurance that made all credit problems, go right. away. Right. But you have these two ignorant extremes that you try to get the money from one, from one place to the other, and in between is the municipal bond industry, and that's where the money's, generated.
And those people aren't ignorant.
They're not. They're knowledgeable. They do this every day.
Yeah, okay. That's good. So, and pay to play, you mentioned.
So, when you're talking about issuers, then you're looking at practices. It's just like campaign finance reform, right? It's just a slippery slope. You can't define it. Nobody really wants. So, you find what are the different ways that you can get somebody's favor and be the chosen person to get the business. Yeah. Right. In some businesses, it might be a box of Omaha steaks. It might be, a favor that you do for someone's child. It might be a charitable contribution to somebody's favorite charity. But, all these things, what are those different ways that curry favor that end up with someone getting a larger proportion of the business than someone else? Right. And so, I think to the credit of the board, this was a rampant problem that existed and got cleaned up certainly before my tenure. But there still were cracks, and people would still find ways to again be the one who was chosen.
Right. Well, wasn't one of the things that was some of these advisors may have been a way to
correct. That's exactly right.
Okay.
Exactly
right. Okay. Yeah. And did the rule go into place while you were there?
On defining the banning of consultants under this non-technical consultants.
Okay.
But the whole financial advisory pay to play continued. These independent financial advisors still could write checks to politicians. And it wasn't until this new rule that's come into place that's been curtailed.
Any other highlights from your time at the MSRB? Things, issues that you worked on?
Ken, those were the big things. I said it was really working through, what do you have that you...
it's a test. Yeah. There's the whole mechanics of the system that you were talking about before, the basically the IT company that they're starting very slowly to build. Mm-hmm. Real-time reporting of financial transactions is starting to come in at this point. Do you remember some of the discussions around that?
Well, I mean, this came into, because then it became the discussion of what is fair price. And I think, you know, here it is, however many years later, the MSRB is trying to create best execution practices. Mm-hmm. And that was, again, evident back in the, again, as we could see more transactions, was the question of in fact, I'll tell you a really good story. As we were getting to the final stages of instituting the real time, it was about to go live, and I'm in a meeting in New York with several members of large firms. One individual becomes a future chairman of the MSRB, as a matter of fact, and his we're sitting there, and so okay, we're going to get these different fields, because now when you start programming things, the what is kind of was, well, this is the way we've always done things, all of a sudden you can't do that anymore, because you're programming things, so things have to be precise and exact, and it has to always be the same. So there was a discussion about portraying yield and price and coupon. So there are different components of a bond, and you have the value of the security. Let's just say it's par. You have the coupon, which is the coupon interest, and then you have the yield. And the yield is a calculation, depends on the price of the bond, whether it's below 100, which is referred to as par, or above 100. And if it's above par, your yield goes down, and if it's below par, your yield goes up, and that relative to the coupon. Mm-hmm. So it comes back to these synthetic securities. So remember, we were talking about variable rate demand notes, which are, again, the securities that were being created through the tender option bond programs. Remember, this is these large leverage programs. Right. So which were really catching fire in a big way while I'm on the board. So the discussion was, okay, if we have a bond, we're going to have a price, we're going to have a yield, and we're going to have a coupon. So I said, well, with the variable rate demand notes, the way they were sold was that the price was always par, and the coupon, price is always par, but the coupon would be changed, would be reset. So it actually had a change of price, right?
Because the
coupon. But we all agreed that it would always be par. But there really was a change in price. Yes. And it was material, whether it was 5% or 3%, because if you were creating a synthetic security and you were taking 6% of a fixed bond and creating a short-term security that had 3%, essentially you were the creator. You took that the other 3%. Mm-hmm. Well, if the remarketing value went down to 1, you made more money. If it went up, you made less money. Right, so. To me, that was the price. So I suggested that we should, instead of having everything be par and the same, is that we should reflect that change and have a field for that. And that was not appreciated. And that didn't get changed until many years later, after 2008.
And why don't you think that idea was accepted?
Well, I was told it was a technology programming issue, but given that this one individual nearly came across the desk to grab my throat, I suggested it had more to do with potential profitability and transparency as to what was the size of that market. And so we were gaining an insight into an area of which the MSRB didn't have regulatory purview.
Right.
I mean, one of the things like during that time was, when when do you go to Congress to change the statute?
Right.
And I think this is one of the challenges right now for the board, you know, as it's evolved and you have this technology company, you have growth of these different products. And here I was on the board, we now have data. We're now seeing more about what's a fair price. How good are these evaluations that are being put on investors' statements? What are the there are different participants in the marketplace that who evolved after 1975. Did the MSRB, did the industry need to go to Congress and change its regulatory statute? And there was a lot of debate and among board members as to whether it's just better to lay low. An argument could be made is nobody's going to hear you, so why expend the energy? Or then, you know, is it something where you're supposed to make that statement because you're an SRO? I was always in the latter camp because I believe that we were, as an SRO, you're held to a higher standard because you're an SRO because you're supposed to bring expertise and a better understanding of change. And so I thought that was critically important.
Can you characterize the sorts of folks that were that would have agreed with you at that point?
It was across the board. It really came down to who you were as an individual and kind of what your own code was.
Interesting.
But again, as I was saying earlier, the risks were really high,
right,
in terms of your job security, yeah, and how much you could do. And I being, while I did business with all these firms, I was in a different position where I had a little bit more, yeah, flexibility to do that and champion that.
Yeah.
You know, we could have made, and you push and push, and then you realize that, you know, there's just a point where, you know, it's just, you know, you have to choose your battles.
Right.
You know?
Well, the MSRB then, and you're talking about all this information that's becoming available and more detail. It seems like every year, every few years, mm-hmm, and at the end, every month, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And your business is sort of the same thing. It's about, mm-hmm, the information. How did that change the way MMA worked?
Immaterial. It's because the data that's available, again, comes back to my perception, is you need to know what the intent of the transaction is.
Mm-hmm.
And without being able to discern that, and without having the granularity of knowing exactly how much is transacted, because there's still not full disclosure. And again, it comes back to there's so few bonds that trade on a daily basis relative to the overall market. And I think even the MSRB statistics show that I think it's right around 50% of all the sales to customers are only done by five firms. Is that it's there's a reason not to have that granular transparency where you could then say, oh, I know where that bond, you know, I could find that bond if I could, you know, I could match it together who the buyer and seller is. I think this is where we talked a lot on how transactions were done, where somebody would buy bonds at a low price and mark them up a certain amount, and over a period of time, a bond would say it started at 50 cents and ended at 80 cents to the, yeah, end transaction. And who's supposed to know what the right price is at that time? And because, again, this is the big challenge in the regulation of this marketplace and the problems associated with liquidity that looks like when you buy stocks or you buy a mutual fund and you do it easily on the phone and you don't worry about it, is that there isn't enough data to create the type of indices and confidence in the evaluations that... it doesn't matter how much data is available. The bonds don't trade. They're not designed to transact in the way that was pioneered by Ned Johnson, creation of mutual funds at the end of the 1970s.
Right.
I mean, really, that event changed the way the municipal marketplace behaved. And in the mid-1990s, in 1995, with the SEC starting to demand that mutual funds represent their performance relative to an index, well, the irony was that these indexes that were created, many of which have high correlations to this MMT data, again, because the market just behaves a certain way, is that then people realized, them being the mutual funds, really realized that it didn't, the nature of the municipal bond is for the income. Performance was over because interest rates had come down from 20%, well, on the taxable side, but let's say municipal bonds were 14, 15%, now they were 5%. There wasn't, you couldn't sell the performance story anymore. So now everything goes to the income. And now the mutual funds make another change. And what they do is they bring traders, a trading desk in, as sort of set of portfolio managers. The portfolio managers exist, but the transactions are done by a trading desk that looks like they're the people selling them bonds. So now they look, everybody's starting to look the same.
Yeah.
And transacted. But it's so now when you're looking at all these prices, again, they're flowing in a different way. You now have proprietary entities that are participating in the market through these tender option bond programs. The futures market introduced proprietary trading and hedge funds, you know, with the these guys, the Susquehannas and others like them. Is it now the flows are not defined? When we were created the consensus, is that that data set we were able to, at its peak, we had 80 different participating firms involved. Now we have 35 because there's been consolidation on this. And what the difference was, and they broke into 6 different groups, and that being the large securities firms, and what we call, you know, let's use them the New York, you know, firms. We then had regional firms that did institutional type business, so we dealt with the mutual funds and tier one accounts is how it's characterized. Then there were regional firms that had a retail operation, and then we had mutual funds, separate managed accounts, which is a growing part of the business, which would be like a firm like Breckenridge, and then we had then the last one were the arbitrage funds or the hedge funds. And those 6 different entities on any individual bond would have a different perspective. And so we could see when we collected these perceptions of where the market was every day, these wide bands of disparity that were consistent with what I was seeing on the board with the transactions themselves, is that depending who the participants were involved, is that there could be wide differences in price. And it and so... you know, that became a... So I've always come back down to, as I was saying earlier, that it's a behavioral market. And it's very thin because you have there's very little that's transacted every day. So a lot of the quantitative measures and the challenges with... You bring as much technology as you want to it, but the data still is not... There isn't enough data and enough of the same data every single day. And the market only trades Tuesdays to Thursdays. Most of the bonds are, you know, most issuers borrow money Tuesdays, Thursdays. So, but Monday and Friday, you still have mutual funds that need prices, that need evaluations. So, you know, depending, so you have these inconsistencies in the market, and of course that creates opportunity.
Yeah. Right? So when you're sort of doing, when you're looking at the market, doing the education that you talk about, you know, if somebody from a regional firm comes to you and wants to know about a certain bond or something, will you give them the insight that is most applicable, what the other regional firms are seeing? This is what regional firms like yourself are, how they're...
I wouldn't say it's that granular, and it, we really characterize... Because we think the data shapes the market so much, is that we can identify areas of the market where there's value and risk that's created by price distortions. And by, we now know how individual bonds are transacted to influence evaluations and pricing. So whether the derivative securities or whether it's the valuation of a mutual fund family's municipal bond holdings, it's pretty straightforward of how to create price discovery. So the municipal market is run by and controlled by the entities at any point in time that are creating the price discovery for that day. And that changes in different eras. But it's very few participants. Those participants provide a very important function. I will say this, I think, because they're loaning their capital to projects. And, like any banker, if you're loaning money, you expect some, you're taking risk and you need to be compensated in order to make that loan. So with all the changes that have happened regulatory-wise, is it has reduced the amount of compensation that people have for taking that risk.
Right.
And remember, Ken, when we started off, is that it's a long-only market. So which means if prices go down, you can't protect yourself. Right? So now if I'm providing you that loan and I have exposure to interest rate movement, I have no ability to protect myself. So at the time of transaction, I have to do something to incent me to loan you the money.
Right.
I have to make whether and in the 2000s, derivatives provided a lot of spread product because it wasn't regulated. Right? So there's a lot of opportunity there. Now we have fewer participants. It's more, the market now is more like it was in the 1970s and early 1980s than it is of 10 years ago. And
just because of the regulatory changes?
Well, one is because you no longer have leverage. You no longer have derivatives, and that dominated the 2000s. From mid 1990s to 2008, it was derivatives that drove the revenue of the industry, facilitated a lot of transactions, a lot of issuers gaining access to the market. And as we were saying earlier, many who probably should not have. Insurance is gone at that point, which provided liquidity because everything was the same. No one had to think, is this bond safe? Is it not? Mm-hmm. Well, I saw Detroit's in trouble. Is this bond like Detroit? Now it's not insured. Insurance provided a very important function because, again, using my analogy to crowdsourcing, right? You're trying to harness all these individuals together in order to make that one big loan. Because ultimately, even though Bank of America, Merrill Lynch may be underwriting $300 million, they're then passing that $300 million off to 1,000 other people in order to do that. And so, how you get it there is that timing is critical because I can't hedge that risk. It's inefficient. So if prices go down during that time, the money that I made by providing the loan might be gone. If I have one of those adverse periods that occur before I can get it to the people who just want to hold on to it because I just want the income.
Well, let's talk about an adverse period. Running up to the crisis, and what was the effect on the market in starting with 2007? I mean, you were looking at this at the effect of all the derivatives way back earlier in the decade.
So August 2007, we get a call from the New York Fed. And the New York Fed calls us because Merrill Lynch had just had their corporate debt downgraded. And they were concerned as to what that might mean at what it would have been for Merrill Lynch, who served as a counterparty in transactions. And the New York Fed had never heard of a tender option bond program. And so they asked us to come in and describe it to them. And at that, they were shocked, by that what had grown to about a $400 or $500 billion segment of the marketplace. And it was that conversation that, for us, gave us a presence in D.C. And from there, that's been, it's been wonderful. It's been really, I learned my first step into DC was the MSRB. This then, a few years later, and probably because I was on the board, probably gave us as a firm, some form of credibility to then be accessible. And then because we were pretty candid in how we talk about things, we were a helpful resource, and we were willing to take the time to educate people.
Did more of that follow in the, in the months after that?
Yeah, tremendous. I mean, we've, the one testimony I did, but we've had three different people from our firm who have testified before numerous different House committees, Senate committees. Federal Reserve is a client, OCC is a client, FDIC is a client, SEC is a client, Pew Foundation is a client. I mean, these are entities that just appreciate our ability to educate them about issues that are confronting the industry, and we try to educate them as best. We try not be, we're not spokesmen for the industry. We're careful about that, but we have our opinion and we understand the data of the market very well.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that pretty significant instance in which you did offer your opinion or yeah. told it straight, which is going to Congress and suggesting that the MSRB be folded into perhaps the SEC or Treasury or whatever. I guess that was the
SEC. I think I was using at the time.
When did that occur? That idea.
It was it was one that was always kind of. Again, it was always part of discussions in any type of regulation of the municipal industry. And the way I described it is that, the point was that we'd seen all these things happen in the industry, the change, and the statute wasn't changing. And from what I had shared with you, the problem with the SRO was because of the position that the municipal dealers, because remember, 10 of the 15 dealers, 10 of the 15 board members were securities firms, is that I believe that they were inhibited from initiating action. And so it was a tough spot to be. I don't really fault anyone for not being able, because it's just hard. I mean, you got a job to do and you're doing this board thing and, it's hard.
I mean, you're essentially saying the SRO model doesn't work.
I think it's severely challenged. I think it's challenged. Yeah. And I think what we're seeing is the industry has grown and has become, and more of the products have evolved in the municipal industry, is that now those products are looking more of what the SEC regulates than what the MSRB statute regulates. So without a change in the statute that's broader to involve all these things, and that I believe that pricing is a significant aspect of the industry that's not regulated by the MSRB. Evaluations on statement time. When I testified to the SEC, year later, maybe, I told them, I said, the only thing that's really important to an individual investor are the two evaluation services and the three leading ratings agencies. And outside of that, the individual investor really doesn't know much about the municipal market. Those entities inform an individual investor every day as to the health of the market. Mm-hmm. So if there's volatility in an evaluation, or whether it's a mutual fund or the individual security an individual owns, that they need to have a resource that explains what that volatility, why it's occurring. Is it because my investment's about to lose its entire value, or which might be something they would hear on CNBC or Bloomberg or something, some headline that's stirred up about chaos, or is it merely a dislocation that's temporary and it's a reflection of the inconsistent liquidity that exists in the municipal market? We're going through one of those periods of time. So an example that's really better than 2008 was the fall of 2010, when at that point, that in the third quarter of that year, Meredith Whitney was in the headlines predicting $100 billion of default. And so had really created a climate of fear around credit risk in the municipal market. And on the Thursday, on Veterans Day of that year, which was a Thursday, as Veterans Day is S&P reduced the reduced the credit rating of 50% of the securities backed by the tobacco settlement, so tobacco bonds, to junk status. On Friday, there, because remember, we don't have a lot of liquidity. Friday, between a Thursday holiday and a weekend, there's not a lot of activity. So there's very limited price discovery. And there were seven transactions in tobacco bonds that day that reflected a 70 basis points, so nearly 1% change in price to the worst. So those mutual funds that had taken risk in the tobacco securities, their net asset values plummeted. So on Saturday morning, when investors in those funds looked at the paper and saw their value, their holdings decline, they wanted out because they didn't know what had happened. Mm-hmm. And so the next week, $5 billion left mutual funds. And for the next 26 weeks, money went out of the municipal bond funds and yields rose very sharply in the municipal market, higher than relative to the treasury yields or to the other interest rates. And there was absolute chaos. That was one of the worst quarters in the fourth quarter 2010 that the municipal industry had experienced. And then I went on CNBC that January and said I didn't agree with her. And
this goes back to seven transactions that were
that occurred in the market. So even if you saw those transactions, which everybody did, but that was the only information that the evaluation services had in order to apply a number on a statement or on a bond that was held by a fund in order to generate an NAV on a statement. And so, again, it's no one's fault, right? It's just that's the Achilles heel of the industry is there is not adequate price discovery for what the expectations are now with all this, with more data than it's had, it's still inadequate. Okay. And it still can't. And that's the challenge. So when I come and look at to your question of the MSRB and should it be a SRO or should it now be part of a larger entity? Well, as I said, as I told many of my colleagues where we had this discussion about what would happen is, well, my ideal, and as I say, since I'm from Massachusetts and we have a lot of people that speak eloquently about ideals, you have a history of that and dreams and things, is that the integration of the MSRB into the SEC would be like having a fine string quartet joining the New York Philharmonic. Mm-hmm. The downside is that it joins the middle school band. Right. it doesn't work. So yeah. It's not so good. So it's bigger isn't always better, but certainly the SEC has had its challenges as well, as there's all these entities. So but I think there still is yet more change to occur with the organization. I'm pretty distant from it now in terms of the initiatives and the expenditures that are being made and the staffing that's been done and where it's headed and all that. But one thing I will say is to Kit Taylor's credit is that he, or two things I give him a lot of positives for is one is he believed that the MSRB shouldn't be a vendor of data. He believed that that was an inherent conflict in its other role as a regulator. And I think that's true. And being somebody who knows the vendor community and knows that data is that when you're asked as somebody who provides data and you're the regulator is saying we want your data and we want it for free, that puts you in a very awkward position as a participant, and that's created a, MSRE is trying to create data. I was called down there in summer of 2012, I think, when they brought all the data providers together, and it was a worthless meeting. And it was after MMD had been cited in a New York Times article, and by one of the board members of saying that it was a manipulative data set. And so everyone was brought down, and, what's the MSRB going to do? And, well, data's not in the regulatory purview and all that. But I think I think that was a good thing. I think there should be a difference. And I think this is true with Emma. I think that there's, we see it in work we do on disclosure. Bloomberg does a better job than Emma does in collecting data, even though they're not the designated repository. The MSRB is a growing technology company as opposed to one that's established. So I think that there is, whatever they're at, again, I don't know the staffing, I don't know the leadership, I don't know. So I think that, but my thought is, maybe it's not the best way that things can be done. They've done some good things, but it's still, there are limits. And then the other thing was that Kit gave me a book called Infectious Greed, which was written by Frank Portnoy, who is now dean of the law school at the University of San Diego, but he was a Morgan Stanley banker, and it was all about the inefficiencies and the evolution of pricing of swaps, of interest rate swaps, and that the interest rate swap market began because proprietary traders who were being compensated not on how well the firm did, but on how well their personal trading line did, is that the innovators of the swap market were pricing their own holdings,
right,
so they could enhance their compensation. And of course, things changed around that. But that was there was a cowboy era, and that was again unregulated. So.
Huge repercussions.
Yeah, but that was a book, and so Kit understood my interest in pricing and the challenges therein, and those two things were
couple other things I want to hit before we wrap up. Recalibration, basically
of ratings.
Of ratings. Uh-huh. There was this conservative ratings approach toward municipals.
Yeah.
Why was that? Why were they in a different?
Well, in fact, one of my employees now, Lisa Washburn, ran the recalibration for Moody's.
Oh.
Ran that effort, and we always believed, based on we as a firm always supported that recalibration, and the reason was is that we thought that municipal bonds were, relative to their corporate counterparts, were rated too conservatively.
Right.
That conservative rating also facilitated the growth of bond insurance, because you had more penal ratings than the municipal market, than municipal issuers deserved. So it created the opportunity for bond insurance. The recalibration, of course, was occurring at the time the market was melting down. So the timing of it was unfortunate. We still think it was the right thing to have done. And now what's the confusion in the market is that Moody's is now adjusting their ratings, higher, and S&P is going the other way on their ratings. So now you have, and I don't know where Fitch is in
relation. Are they converging, or are they going?
They're diverging right now. They're going the other way. So that's, of course, confusing to investors.
Yeah.
Right? So if you have the individual investor trying to gather information, goes, why are there these two trends? And recalibrations lost, how would I know that? Again, are two extremes of ignorance.
So it's still underway, isn't it?
Yeah. It's going to take time to work itself out.
Okay. And Dodd-Frank, have we seen any changes in the municipal market directly?
Well, we're directly involved in we have a business that's been an outgrowth of Dodd-Frank. And it's been kind of interesting. Is that one of the it comes back to coming on the same topic of credit evaluation and rating. Now, you know, since the bond insurer's demise, all those people that were let go, you know, and I was saying earlier about cost cutting, well, now they've had a resurgence. They're now highly compensated, and it's a popular profession to be a municipal credit analyst. You know, it's a good time to be have that. So it's a good skill, and that's terrific. But with Dodd-Frank, one of the parts of Dodd-Frank was that the banks, who are now the third largest holders of municipal bonds and the fastest growing segment holding of municipal bonds over the last 5 years. And why is that? It's because they couldn't make loans, right? There's no loan demand.
Right.
So for homes, and so they needed to generate revenue, and a comparable revenue stream was generated and credit safety was a municipal bond and a long-dated, long-maturing bond. So they increased their bond holdings. It became a real important source of demand because the tender option bond programs disappeared, as I was talking about earlier, and you needed somebody else to fill the gap to kind of on the margin to absorb, to facilitate, especially for smaller issuers, access to capital. So the bank stepped in at a good time, still performing their loan function, but doing it through the capital markets. So their investment portfolios grew. What was happening, though, and this is what ties to Dodd-Frank, is that many of these were community banks. So they have a relatively small dollar value of an investment portfolio in municipal bonds, but they have many, many, many issuers. And they don't have the professional staff to evaluate the credit, and they certainly can't expend the money that a larger bank would be able to expend or a mutual fund to do the same level of credit review. So Dodd-Frank imposed regulation on the banking entities, the bank regulatory entities, that a part of the examination process is the review of the credit worthiness of the municipal bond, and a process that wasn't solely dependent on ratings. So we developed a metric, a cost-effective metric, so that the banks could remain in the municipal market, so it wouldn't be so costly for them to remain involved as a loan provider. And so we do that for over 200 banks.
Huh. You know?
And it's fun, and you get a real slice of America by, you know, all these small banks that have these, you know, investment portfolios that have kept them alive in through here.
Interesting. And in that respect, it's another way that the market's gone back to the 70s and 80s.
Correct.
The banks are back.
Because your largest holders are individuals, mutual funds, and banks. And banks are closing in on the mutual funds.
Hmm. Terrific. Anything else we should talk about that we haven't covered?
I think that covered. That gives you more than enough, for sure.
It's you did well in pursuing the whole education thing, because this has been really good for me.
Looking
forward to working it into the gallery as it goes forward.
Good.
So thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. Yeah.